Before the worship service started, someone who shall remain nameless asked me if this was me on the cover of the bulletin. It's not. In large part because I'm not nearly that brave. Maybe some of you know this story. Maybe some of you saw the movie that was made about this story, though how one could make a two-hour movie off of this story, I have no idea. But on the morning of August 6th, 1974, Philippe Petit went out and tightrope walked between the two towers. 1,350 feet off the ground. No net, no safety cable, no parachute, just a man with a 55-pound balancing pole on a wire. And he traversed this 138-foot gap between the two towers, not once, not twice, but eight times. He walked it, he danced it, he laid down on it, he knelt upon it. And when all was said and done, 45 minutes later, he had made eight trips across it. I would submit to you that with a little less twinkle in his eye and a little less skip in his step, the preacher of Ecclesiastes, also known as Qohelet, is doing basically the same thing. He's walking, if you will, upon a tension between not two towers, but two poles of thought. On the one hand, he's got the pole of what he knows to be true because he is, in fact, a Jew born into the covenant people of God and raised and steeped in Jewish wisdom literature. He's cast himself in the Solomon persona. He has to know that. That's one pole. But the other pole is what we might call the personal observation pole. The pole in which he looks out to examine all the things that he can see and realizes that something doesn't line up here. And what he does is he walks back and forth between these poles. Just when you think he's gone too far and he's going to deny God altogether, he turns around and says something that gives you a little bit of hope. And just when you think, well, maybe he's left the observation behind, he turns around again. And so you've got to follow him. You have to follow him into the tension. Because if he falls to either side, just like Philippe Petit, it would be devastating and almost certainly deadly. To fall into the side of observation alone would be to deny the God of his heritage and the God of his life. And that would kill him. But to deny the fact that he sees things that seem out of sort, to deny that his investigations have any merit or truth, would be to deny the very wisdom that God has gifted him with. And he can't do that either. And so Qohelet walks this tension. He walks this tension, and he does it in ways that are unsettling, and he does it in ways that maybe you and I don't like so much, but what he does is he invites us to join him in the tension. Because perhaps walking the tension is the greatest wisdom of all. And so this morning, he's going to walk this tension looking at time. Last week, he looked at pleasure and madness and folly and wisdom. This week, he's going to look at the one thing under which all of those must fall. So we're going to read perhaps the most well-known passage in Ecclesiastes this morning. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, the first 15 verses. If you would rise for the reading of God's word, if you are able. For everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born, and a time to die. A time to plant, and a time to pluck up what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to break down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to seek and a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to cast away. A time to tear and a time to sow. A time to keep silence and a time to speak. a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. What gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. That which is already has been. That which is to be already has been. And God seeks what has been driven away. This is the word of the Lord. Please be seated. So Kohelet's out to investigate time, to figure out what he can say about life under the sun, not so much in the manner of living, but rather in the fact that he knows that there is a time for living and a time for dying. Kohelet is out to tell us those things. Now look, what he's going to say goes really far to one pole before it turns around and comes back the other way. And so what I'm asking you to do with me this morning is to walk with me, to walk with him on this line of tension, and to allow Kohelet to lead us to one side and then the other. Because here's the thing, he's not Macbeth. Not completely. Not always. But if he heard Macbeth say, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day, to the last syllable of recorded time, and all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death, out, out, brief candle. If he heard that, he might say, Macbeth, you've been reading my book. But he's not quite Macbeth. But he's also not the Rolling Stones singing, time is on my side. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. He's somewhere between those two poles. He gets close to both sides, but he never lets go of the tension. He can't. But the one thing we can be sure of is this: by the end of this, no matter where he might be on this spectrum, he can at least conclude this, that time's not really on your side. It's not. It's not on your side in any way that's satisfactory. And so he begins, 3 verse 1, for everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. You know this. I think probably everyone living who's old enough to have cognitive capabilities knows this. Okay? We have co-opted this into our speech, and my guess is it's not because we've done a lot of reading of Ecclesiastes. Okay? But we tell our children and our students and one another, there's a time for that. Now's not the time. Okay? You know this. Kohelet knows this. And you know what? There's wisdom in knowing this. Right? There's one of the poles. There's wisdom in knowing this. You have to know when something is appropriate to do. And so you come to a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. Those things need to be done at proper times. Plant in the season when you're supposed to reap doesn't do any good. Try reaping in the season when you're supposed to plant. There's nothing to reap. Okay? You need to know when these times are. A time to speak and a time to be silent. You need to know when those times come. And Proverbs is full of examples of this. Proverbs 26 has two back-to-back Proverbs that say this. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. Do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you become like him. The only way to know the difference between those is to figure out when the appropriate time to speak is. Right? This is what Kohelet is letting you know. But is Kohelet just making a bald statement of sort of gnomic or aphoristic wisdom here that kind of everybody already knows? I don't think so. I don't think that's what he's doing. Because if we're going to treat chapter 3 within the context of Ecclesiastes, then here's what we already know. Wisdom is not enough. Chapter 2 has told us that a life that is lived in order to gain its fulfillment simply from wisdom is not enough. It's vain. It's absurd, is what Kohelet says. It's necessary. It's better than foolishness, but it's not enough. We've already had a sneak peek at what Kohelet thinks about time because the narrator in the first 11 verses of chapter 1 has told us this, right? The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. What marks time? Basically, the rising and setting of the sun. And what is the narrator's point in this? This is how it works. Sun rises and the sun sets, and then it comes back around again, does the same thing all over again. Kohelet's not making a bald statement of wisdom that is supposed to be known by everybody. He's reminding you we're still in the absurd. We haven't left it behind. Mist, smoke, vapor, still there. And in a sense, time makes that noticeable. Because what's the first line in the poem that begins in verse 2? There's a time to be born and a time to die. Kohelet's a downer. But he's just being honest. The very existence that you and I have is defined by the poles of life and death. Everything that happens to you, from you, with you, in you, has to occur in these two poles. Because if you've never been born, you don't exist. But if you have been born, you will die. That's what Kohelet's reminding us of. He's reminding us that all that might come after this, whether it's planting and reaping, whether it's tearing and sowing, whether it's speaking and remaining silent, all that happens is still surrounded by these two poles. So you know what? Living wisely may not actually pay off all that well. You know this, I think. Experientially, we know this. You have had moments in your life, my guess is, that when you have pursued relationships, when you have done the Matthew 18 principle, when you have done everything you can do according to the godliness of wisdom, and you have still failed. Nice guys finish last. And so do wise guys and gals. Don't they? They do. And so he begins by reminding us both of the necessity of wisdom, but also of its inadequacy. It is necessary and yet inadequate. And from verses 2 through 8 in that beautiful poem, he essentially shows us this applies to everything. Everything under the sun. Every matter under heaven, it applies to everything. And so he lays out a range of experiences meant to cover essentially all of life, from birth to death and everything in between, physical toil, emotional states, the actions of nations and countries and kingdoms. Okay, it's all included in this list. Times to build and times to tear down, whatever you might think of, it has a category somewhere in here. And Kohelet essentially saying, you need to know this. It's wise to know this, but the wisdom itself is insufficient. Is there wisdom in knowing your own mortality? Of course there is. The psalmist cries out and says, God, teach me to number my days. Why? So that I may gain a heart of wisdom. In another place, he calls out and he says, God, show me what is the measure of my days and how fleeting I am. And in verse 14 of this chapter, Kohelet will say that God has done these things so that people will fear before him. And if the fear of the Lord is the beginning of both knowledge and wisdom, and knowing the number of your days or learning to number your days gives you a heart of wisdom, then there must be some sort of relationship and connection between the fear of the Lord and your own mortality. And there is. Because once you recognize that you are not eternal and infinite, that you have an end, you start to ask, is there anything eternal? And then when you come to see the one who is in fact seated on the throne, all of a sudden it makes sense and you say, oh, I get it now. I'm not the center of the universe. He is. And so you begin to say, okay, this makes sense. I understand how these things fit together. A knowledge of our own finiteness ought to lead us to the fear of God. A knowledge of the impermanence of all things ought to lead us to fear of God. and also ought to lead us where he puts us in verses 12 and 13, to take joy in eating and drinking and pleasure, to know the time is fleeting, to know that these things will not last forever, so enjoy them. There's wisdom here. There is, absolutely. Qohelet knows this. He's telling you, this is good. This is a gift from God, is what he says. But you know what? It doesn't matter how well you recognize this. It doesn't matter how well you walked the aged and saged path of wisdom. The reality is, you still die. And that still profits you nothing. And if you don't believe me, then look past the poem to verse 9 and ask this question to yourself. What gain has the worker from his toil? What profit? What is lasting from what you and I are going to do? You want to know what's lasting? Nothing. I walked around a graveyard yesterday, which is not a normal Saturday practice, but I walked around a graveyard yesterday and saw hundreds of graves. Hundreds of them. Children, full-grown adults, and some names are no longer legible. Some names are simply not known, and so on top of it, it's written unknown. That person's name didn't last long enough for someone to record it. So in 1818, Percy Shelley writes this poem that's on the front of your bulletin called Ozymandias. Ozymandias is the Greek name for Ramses II. And around the time that Shelley wrote this poem, he knows that the British Museum is in the process of acquiring parts, and I say parts because that's what it is, of the statue of Ramses II. And it inspires him to write these words. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculpture well those passions read, which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hands that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal these words appear, my name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. I doubt that most of you have the kind of authority that Ramses had. My child, I like to draw pictures. Well, things that are supposed to be pictures. And I have no doubt that someday when she's not looking, we will have to take the ones off the fridge to make room for the ones that she wants to put on the fridge, right? And I don't know what's going to happen to those pictures. My guess is they'll make it into the garbage can somewhere. And maybe when she's older, she'll make little Play-Doh figurines. And maybe she'll make Mama and Dada. And you know what? That's not going to last either. Play-Doh's made to be squished and made into something else. It doesn't really matter. Whether it's stone, whether it's glass, whether it's reputation, the world suffers from a chronic and incurable disease called impermanence. That's the reality. So is it wise to know that you are mortal? It is. Is it wise to understand that things are impermanent? It is. But brothers and sisters, the wisdom of knowing that doesn't change it. It can do little for you except to remind you that ultimately this is the state of everything under the sun. That's what Qohelet is saying. And you say, okay, well, what about created orderliness? Right? Doesn't Qohelet speak here about making everything beautiful in its time and about planting and sowing and reaping and things like that? He does. He does. Again, here's the other pole. He acknowledges this. There is a time to plant and a time to uproot what is planted. And God has made everything beautiful in its time. It's a creational order. It's a necessary order. You can do virtually none of the other things on the list unless there's some kind of reliability. Even waging war requires some kind of reliability. Right? Don't believe me? Go back and read 2 Samuel 11. passage with David and Bathsheba. But how does it start? In the spring, in the times when kings go off to war, right? Even warfare, to some extent, requires something of a regularity and a dependability. That is absolutely true. It's covenantally true because God promised it to Noah after the flood. Can you imagine being Noah? And all of a sudden the boat docks somewhere and you look around and you think, what is going to happen to the world now? And so God tells him, for as long as the earth persists, day and night, summer and winter, springtime and harvest will never cease. It's a covenantal order. But beloved, Kohelet would hear that and he would say, absolutely, without question, that is true. And you know what? You say, okay, well, what about the beauty? Isn't it beautiful? Commentators across all kinds of spectrums have said the word beauty there is a reference back to the creational order of very good. I mean, isn't that true, Kohelet? What would you say to that? And he would say, I'm not denying the truth of that. I'm asking you whether or not that really helps you. Does it help you? Because here's the thing. What happens if the time to heal doesn't come before the time to plant? And you can't make it into your field. What happens then? Does the fact that you know when the season is coming benefit you anything? What happens if the time to build is also met with the time to die? And the house that you're building goes unoccupied. Does that benefit you at all? Does the reliability of being able to tell when it might rain and when it won't, despite our inability apparently to do that, is that actually going to benefit you long term, given everything else that you know? What gain has the worker from his toil? Kohelet would ask you. Yes, there's beauty, but you know what's true about verse 11? And I'm sorry to do this to you. I know this verse decorates throw pillows and refrigerator magnets all over Christendom, okay? But here's the reality. Verse 11 is part of the tension. Because it doesn't say, and he has made all things beautiful in your time. It doesn't say he has made all things beautiful when you need them to be. It says he has made all things beautiful in its time. But what if your time ends before its time comes? You never get to see the flower bloom. How does that help? How is that ultimately any good? We're still dealing in the absurd here. Time and its seasons play the coquette with wisdom and folly. They whisper to you and they say, you need to do things when it's proper. And then you do things when it's proper and it says, but ultimately it doesn't matter. Ultimately it doesn't matter. And even if you manage somehow to navigate such that you never experience the side of folly, even if that's true, time comes back and still whispers, you still die. I still get your king. Checkmate. And that's actually a relatively good illustration for this, isn't it? Because we're not talking about determinism here. Ecclesiastes is not telling you everything has been so determined that there's no choices you ever have and you're just an automaton and God is up there like some giant claymation specialist or puppeteer controlling your every action. But have you ever played chess against somebody really, really good? I have. It doesn't really matter what you do. Does it? I mean, my choices aren't chosen for me, but they might as well be. Because in the end, I look down and my king is on its side and I think, where did that come from? You can trade pieces all you want. You can go through an entire game of chess and you can say, I got your queen. And then you look down and your king is dead. How does that happen? I don't know. I'm not a very good chess player. But here's where the tension is, right? And here's ultimately where the tension lies for Kohelet. Because it's not just that you're playing chess against someone better than you, you're playing chess against God. That's what Kohelet would say. Look at verse 10. After he asks the question, what gain is there? He says this, I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. And after you leave that beautiful poem of all those infinitives, a time to do and a time to do and a time to do, all of a sudden you hit action verbs. And you know what? All of the action verbs are God's. They're not yours. God has made, God has put, God has set. The only action verbs that belong to you are verbs of inability. Man cannot find what God has done from beginning to end. That's what Kohelet says. The problem here isn't that you're playing chess. The problem is that you're playing chess against God. And the real rub is this. Verse 11 doesn't just say he has made everything beautiful in its time. It also says God has put olam, which is translated here as eternity, but probably not in the sense that you generally think of eternity, more so in the sense that you understand there's something bigger and broader and longer lasting than you. You understand that there's a picture being painted, a tapestry being woven, but what? But you can't figure out what it is. You don't see the big picture. And that's frustrating. Have you ever seen one of those 3D images? Has anybody ever handed one of those pieces of cardboard that looks like a bunch of squiggles and lines and dots and colors? And then if you stand on one foot and lick your left thumb and raise your right eyebrow and cross your eyes, you're supposed to be able to see a 3D image? Have you seen this? It's like the most complicated set of steps in the world to see a picture, right? But it's really cool when you can see it. All of a sudden, somebody has told you there's a picture here, and you do it just right, and there it is. Or so I've been told. Turns out I have a spatial problem of sorts that basically disables me from being able to see the picture. And so I'm handed this picture, and somebody says, it's beautiful, it will open up new worlds for you. And I look at this thing, and I cross one eye, and then the other, and then both, and nothing happens. It's flat, and it's frustrating. I know there's a picture there, but I cannot see it. Now imagine the irony that I'm married to a woman who does 3D animation for a living. Our dinner conversations are basically an exercise in talking past each other. So, this is what Kohelet is saying. You know that there's a picture there. You do. You know that there's something bigger and something even beautiful. He's willing to call it beautiful. But if you can't see it, if you don't know what it is, then what's the point? Say, okay, hold on. Go into the dark side. Not yet. Not yet, because he'll turn around again in verse 12, a little bit. And he'll say this, I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. In verse 10, it was business that God had given to man. In verse 13, it's a gift. What happened? It came back the other way a little bit. Not all the way, but enough so that you realize he hasn't fallen off the deep end yet. He's willing to acknowledge that there are good things to be had in this world and in this life. But then you get to verse 14 and you see something similar. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Those words are the words that will find praise and adulation and exaltation throughout the Psalms, right? That God has set these things in place, that God knows the number of stars and has called them each by name, okay? These are worthy of exaltation. But then verse 15 reminds you, and yet everything has already been. And God seeks what has been driven away or what has been pursued, ultimately saying, God's just bringing back around again the things that have already happened. And so Kohelet walks back and forth between these two poles. Here's the tension. God has set olam into man's hearts, but here's the thing. Only God's work endures olam. That's what it says in verse 14. But what I want you also to know is this. There's a switch in the verbs between verses 10 and 12 and 14 that give you a key to what he's thinking and how he's thinking about it. In verse 10, he says what he says across the book of Ecclesiastes. I have seen my angst, my vexation, my frustration is because I have seen these things. But in verses 12 and 14, the verb changes. And I'm going to tell you, I don't like the ESV's translation of perceived because it sounds the same as seen. What it says is, I know. In verse 10, he says, I have seen what God has done. In verse 12, he says, I know that there's nothing better for man. I know that it's a gift of God. In verse 14, I know that whatever God does forever, but that's the problem. That's what creates the tension. What he knows and what he sees come into conflict in his world and in his life in such a way that he cannot make sense of them. And brothers and sisters, he's not alone in that. Kohelet's desire to make sense of the tension in life is your desire too. It's everyone's desire. Everyone is looking out at the world and seeing there's got to be something better than this. Something to break this cycle because time is oppressive. When your clock went off this morning an hour earlier than normal, you knew how oppressive time was. So what's the resolution? How do we break the cycle? Remember Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? The children finally all cross over into Narnia. And they find out this. They find out that Narnia has been afflicted with a curse such that it is always winter, never Christmas. That's where Kohelet is. But there's also a prophecy, isn't there? There's a prophecy about someone who's coming. And the prophecy says, when Aslan comes, right, what will happen? When Aslan bares his teeth, winter meets its death. When he shakes his mane, we shall have spring again. Brothers and sisters, do you smell it? Spring is in the air. Because, spoiler alert, Aslan is the Christ figure. And Christ has come. You heard it. You heard it in our assurance of pardon. At the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. In Galatians 4, Paul says, in the fullness of time, that he was born of a virgin under the law to redeem those who are under the law so that they might become sons and daughters of God. The only way to break the cycle of time is to submit to the one who is above time, but who submitted himself to time at just the right time to save you from time. Brothers and sisters, Jesus has stepped into the world in history, the climax of redemptive history, to whisper, to yell to you, it's not absurd. It is not absurd. You do not toil in vain. There is an inheritance that will never perish, spoil, or fade, and it is kept for you in the place I have prepared for you. If it were not so, I would have told you. Jesus is the fulfillment of time. And in fulfilling time, he has taken away the curse of time. Because that's what Hebrews tells us. That he was made in every way like his brothers, so that he could defeat him who held the power of death over you. The only way in which absurdity can be answered is with a life that does not end. And in Lent, that's what we're waiting for, isn't it? Aren't we looking forward to Easter? Aren't we looking forward to the resurrection, not only to be reminded of a singular event, but to be reminded that we will share in his resurrection? That answers the absurdity. Jesus takes the points of tension into himself and says, I will tell you in one word how this is taken care of. Tetelestai. It is finished. That's it. It's done. All the work that needed to be done, all the cycles that were seemingly endless have been broken. The power of sin and death and Satan himself have been conquered. It is done. It's fulfilled. It's been completed. Spring is in the air. And because of what he has done, you know that there is a time coming that will never end, where there will be no more pain, sorrows, or tears anymore. So you can be encouraged to go out and to proclaim to a world that is toiling endlessly without any chance of profit that there is one who would come and change their absurdity into beauty, so that you can go back and read verse 11 the way you want to and know that there is beauty to be had. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost. Amen.